Yeah, I'm just on the verge of finishing the longest story in my next book, which is going to clock in at 46 pages.
Okay.
So get that last page going this week, I think.
Just doesn't slow down.
Can't slow down, you know, or, you know, it's hard to crank up again. It's just a fact of life. You know, I've learned that the hard way. So you got to keep it going, you know, and you go, oh God, I can't take it. But really the alternatives are much worse. So just keep it going. Besides, you know, over the years, it's come to be more like my comfort zone. There was a time when I hated drawing and stuff, you know, but gradually I got to like it. Gradually it got to be what works for me.
Now you're saying great stuff that's good for the interview, so we might as well start.
Oh, yeah, okay.
You're listening to Ink Studs, and my guest this week is Kim Deitch. Kim's latest work is How I Make Comics, as well as a recent re-release of Reincarnation Stories. Kim also has a substantial body of work that you could explore very, very well at better comic stores and bookstores that go back. And as I was kind of prepping for this, in the back of How I Make Comics, you talk about starting your artistic career in 1966.
Yeah, so that's fair. You know, I started getting printed in early 67. Yeah.
So would this be 60 years of
coming up on 60 years? Astonishing, yeah. But it's the truth.
You know, we're talking before about the kind of creativity of having to go, or is that like the creative spirit needs to be constantly rejuvenated, or is that the physical thing of actually drawing and keeping those muscles alive and engaged?
I'd say it's a little of both, really.
Yeah.
And, you know, I always hoped it would turn out this way. And, you know, I'm just delighted that it has. You know, I lasted this long. Christ. I never really thought it would. And now that it's happened, you know, it makes me very happy.
You're 82, I think.
You got it.
There we go. Yeah. It's, and still making incredibly vital work and creative work. And I always think about something you said to a friend years ago, and he doesn't remember, but I remember the term, because he gave you one of his comics, and it's a little wild out there comic, and you said to him something along the lines of, like, you just got to tell a good yarn.
Well, that's pretty good. That's a pretty good statement. That's definitely a big part of it. And yeah, it's very interesting. You know, and I've come to the point where I really love to do it. Took a long time, and I got there. I had to clean up my act a little bit, you know, and all that kind of stuff.
I mean, with the latest book, How I Make Comics, you talk a lot about your kind of storytelling process and how you bounce things off your wife, Pam, and that kind of thing. And do you feel like, you mentioned a second ago how you're kind of working to that point. Is there a time where, like, as you're going through the underground days and doing whatever, you know, newspaper, do you kind of have a wider idea of, like, where I want to go with this? Or is that something that just kind of came out through trying these different directions to settle into this kind of longer form story?
Yeah, it just kind of evolved. Plus, if you got a long story, you know where you got something to do. In fact, I'm a little terrified right now that, you know, I'm going to hit page 46 and I got to start another story, although I got an idea in my head. But, you know, starting is tough. I like to overlap a little bit, but I'm so concerned with the last page of this story that I just think I'm going to drive through. It'll probably get me to the end of the week, and then I'll do a little futzing around on Saturday about getting the next one started, which I know what the story will be, because it'll be a true story. And again, you know what I seem to be hitting at a lot more, and it surprised me because it's not a plan. It's more and more the autobiographical thing is finally catching up with me. You know, I know a lot of people, that's was their main shtick, and it's sort of becoming my shtick lately. And, you know, the next story I'm doing, it's a childhood story about a woman singer that I knew about when I was a kid named Connie Converse, who we all thought was just going to be the next big thing, and it didn't happen.
Yeah.
But she was fascinating because, you know, she played the guitar and was kind of folky, but it wasn't really the folk music genre. In fact, what fascinates me about her now, thinking about it, like what she reminds me of in terms of other music is like Rodgers and Hart and that kind of thing, you know, which very, very clever and interesting lyrics and great melodies. I'd say Richard Rodgers is about my favorite of the, you know, classic American popular standard guys. So
when you're, I mean, there's something about like there's a kernel of truth in every lie and every story. Yeah. And you say about how you're veering into more direct autobio, but you've been a character in your work pretty consistently for quite a while now.
Yeah, you know, and still things happen. Like this story I just did, which is basically about how I got my start in art, called Living the Dream. It's true, essentially, but there's a few places where, I don't know, things, you know, I'd written some really outlandish stuff and decided, oh, that won't be any good. But then I, you know, I showed it to Pam and she liked those parts. So some of that, a little bit of fiction, I'd say maybe about 10, 15% fiction seeped into even this story. How I got my start in art, basically, is what it's about. But it starts off, it's basically me going from working in a nut house to becoming a published artist. And, you know, working in the nut house was pretty wild, you know. And basically, the punchline of my story is that, like, it's just like all this stuff that happened in the nut house, it's kind of catching, you know, and I think I caught some of it. But then the punchline is the way I caught it was that suddenly, you know, if I was being driven a little bit crazy, my crazy was it got me back going in art again. Because, like, I went to art school for 2 years and it really, you know, I wasn't really fitting in there. At a certain point, I found out that you could ship out in the Merchant Marine. Nearby, there was a Seaman's Union, and I went out there, you know. So I took a leave of absence and shipped out in the Merchant Marine. I never really came back to Pratt. I went back and took a few courses. But then the comics thing started taking off. And, you know, I even started, yeah, after about a year of that and thinking, oh, shit, this isn't working, I started you know, making some money. By the time I've been at it for about a year, suddenly I was on salary at East Village Inn, $40 a week. Doesn't seem like much now, but then we had all these fringe benefits, like we could charge our art supplies, and there was a big nightclub that we could just go over and have all the free drinks we wanted. I mean, it was really kind of nice once it really got rolling. And that's how it was until I left New York. Go back to everybody. At a certain point, everybody was going to the West Coast.
Yeah,
it's just like lemmings marching to the sea, and I was no exception. You know, next thing you know, I was setting up in the Bay Area, had a girlfriend and a kid, and all that sort of thing.
But you're always a New Yorker by heart.
I was born in Los Angeles, actually. Yeah. But I'd say at this point, yes, I feel now I'm a New Yorker. And I enjoy that. And I enjoy thinking of myself in that way. It took a long time to get there. But that's kind of right now, yeah. You know, We've been like, you know, for years I was living out of a suitcase and just going here and there. But we've been in where you see me now for about 32 years.
Oh, wow.
And I've been married for ever since 2000. Actually, our relationship goes back about the same amount of time. So I complain a lot, but I shouldn't, because really, you know, I'm having a wonderful life.
Even you're doing so, what you love.
Yeah, that's the thing. If I just stop myself every now and then, say, Kim, stop, think about it. What do you got to really kick about, you know? It's been, you know, I've been incredibly fortunate, and no mistake.
You bring up the working in the nut house, in the insane asylum, yeah, and how that's kind of, you know, and I was thinking about just like the parade of misfits that come through your work, and people with hard done lives and going through difficult moments, and thinking about D.W. Griffith and the reincarnation stories near the end of his life. And I wonder, at such a young age, like how old were you, like 19, 20 working there? That must, like, everything about that experience is probably so...
I was 20 years old at the nut house. Yeah. That's right.
And that's really an informative time. You know, that's when people go to university.
Yeah, well, I tried a few years of that too. And I could have gone back to Pratt, graduated. What do I want to do that for? You know, it's, I'm in this thing. I'm getting paid. Shit. So, you know, because I was still like some kind of a crazy person. I was a functional alcoholic and, you know, taking too many drugs and all of that. But I've pretty much gotten over that over the years. Smoke a little weed, but that's about it. Even right now, I could pass a drug test. So
how do you see it? Because I mean, you talk about drinking, quitting drinking a little bit and stuff, and I'm curious for yourself, your own creativity and like how that change in your approach and your ability getting rid of that kind of devil in your life.
It's tricky business, and I've seen some people clean up their act that way, and suddenly the creative thing is gone. Thank the good Lord, that isn't my situation. Because, you know, yeah, I've seen that. So I don't know what to advise people what to do. You know, it seems to me like I got one guy to get off the booze, and then all the color left his work.
But yeah,
mentioning no names here because that wouldn't be right.
No. But I'm curious about your experience, though, and how, because if anything, you've been more prolific with time.
I lucked out. It worked out. You know, I managed to clean up my act. It took joining AA to quit drinking. But
yeah,
that didn't, you know, it was okay. You know, besides, AA was so fascinating. I was living in North Carolina at the time. Going to AA in North Carolina, it was better than TV. You know, it was like so damned entertaining. I heard so many damn good stories in there. It wasn't even funny. So
is that something that like you find work weaves into your work, is like thinking back these stories? I mean, obviously filtered through several layers, but there's something of a nugget you hear of something at some point and just like, I'm gonna throw that in with this like character that's going through these tough times.
Oh, it definitely happens. Yeah, you know, I get a lot of ideas from my own life, other people I know. My brother Simon was a great, great influence on me. I think without him, I might not have drifted into this comic thing. You know, when we were kids, my mother managed to wean me somewhat from comic books, so I was actually read books. That never happened with Simon, but then yeah. Instead, he became this fantastic scholar of comics and comic books. And I learned so much about that, that was a huge thing that pushed me towards getting into this thing. And so, you know, I always have to give him credit for that. And then I thought, okay, I'm in it. We're going good. I tried to partner up with him in comics, but it only worked up to a point. You know, he just didn't have the work ethic. And, well, you know, he's no longer even alive, you know, so what are you going to do? Yeah. Sad. I think about him all the time.
In the back of How I Make Comics, I mean, both that and the Resurrection Comics, you have a kind of eulogy at the end of them for
How I Make
Comics.
Yeah.
And so, I mean, pardon?
That's what you're talking about, right? That little, I figured I, you know, it seemed to me like I had to explain myself a little bit. And plus I had some good tips. I mean, I think that tip about the 2 hour threshold, if you can just sit there for 2 hours and really train yourself to do that, that's a very useful thing. You know, some days when you get started, maybe nothing really good is happening, but if you can just sit there and do something, it's creating a useful habit that you can then go on with.
I was thinking of at the end of How I Make Comics, you talk about the park near your house with the with the Peter Pan sculpture. And I think Simon there. And that's what I was wondering about, like, because I mean, in the back of Resurrection Stories, you have very explicit things about Spain and Jay Lynch. And I'm wondering if at the end, in that part, is kind of being less explicit, but kind of wanting to send a message.
It's just a great place. I mean, I just like to go in there and look around. The Peter Pan statue, I believe I discovered it was in some movie house and ended up there. I mean, at one point, a bunch of kids grabbed it off its pedestal and threw it in the East River, but they fished it out again, and it's there now. That was before my time, before I discovered it. This neighborhood where I live in, which is East 86th Street, it's edging towards Spanish Harlem, but not in Spanish Harlem. It's wonderful. There's a wonderful sort of small town atmosphere. They used to call it Germantown. It was like all the German Americans lived. In fact, you know who lived in this neighborhood for a while, even after he was world famous, was Lindbergh. In fact, maybe that's where he got some of his Nazi associations. Because this neighborhood, it was like a lot of German Americans, but also a lot of German Jews. It was a cool place.
So it still has that.
Well, it is a cool.
Now, looking at your work, you in these works especially, there's a lot of like talk about your youth and your childhood. And one of the things I wonder about, because you had a complex childhood, creative, active father.
Yeah.
Pretty pinko parents.
Really pinko, yeah. Communist.
Yeah.
Even.
But also some calamity at home and some, you know.
Well, all broke up, you know.
Yeah. I mean, how old were you when your parents divorced?
About 16, 17, in that area. It was very sad, you know, because they had for what it was worth, while it lasted, it was a good marriage. And I think I was the key beneficiary of it because I was the first one out. And, you know, they pounded it into my head. Well, we don't exactly care what you do with your life, but something creative, you know, they just got it in my head. I ought to do something creative. And that was a great blessing to me that they did that to me. You know, and they were practically kids themselves. My old man was 19 years old when I was born. I mean, and it was great. But I could see, you know, it's like different sets. It starts to happen. Suddenly, I noticed like all their friends were getting divorced. And I could just sort of feel divorce creeping up on my family. And it finally happened. My father was traveling a lot and got involved with another woman. And, you know, very sad because it didn't hurt me that much, but it was hell on my mother. And I don't think she was ever the same after that. You know, that was the saddest thing about it. And my two brothers, I don't know. They should speak for themselves. But, you know, me personally, if anything, it kind of was liberating. I could start to be my own guy and do what I wanted to do in the world. Maybe I went even a little wild, you could say. But it didn't hurt me. If anything, yeah, it freed me up and helped me in some weird way. But with proviso that it was heartbreaking what it did to my mother, you know.
And one of the things you talk about in one of the books is wanting to make that space for your mother in your work and thinking about, like, it's been understood. Well, and I really appreciate that because there's a little bit of, like, you know, your father's, like, there's a bit of, like, myth, the man, the legend, who's this, like, you know, big man theory, this important person in not just your life, but a lot of people's lives. But your mother had just an important part in your life. Yeah. And it's like this, like, kind of lost history, but that also kind of connects with what you do with your work of documenting these lost histories.
Yeah, well, I think I wanted to give her some credit that, you know, that everybody goes, hey, tell us more about your old man and this and that. And that's how he was, too, with, you know, when we were doing joint appearances and stuff together. And that was great. But my poor mother, I don't know why she couldn't bring herself out of that. But it was a bad thing and a sad thing. And so I wanted to talk about her a little. And yeah. I think that story, The Two Maries, I think that's the best story in there, at least for me, you know. And I'm glad I had the opportunity to do it.
And I'm also thinking about the story at the beginning of the resurrection stories with the young Kim being harassed by a very drunk D.W. Griffith and Mum the Protector. Oh, and yeah. Really see, like, being mindful of bringing your mother in as a part of these childhood stories, because really when you think about childhood, mothers are...
She keeps coming up, you know, I keep doing these stories and the first thing you know, I'm talking about her again. And I think that's just fine, you know?
Yeah.
Because she's an interesting character. I mean, you know, to be dispassionate about it, you know, there's a lot to work with there. I mean, she was... My there's actually three Maries, because the third Marie is my great-grandmother, Marie Fitzgerald, who was absolutely insane. You know, they say she murdered somebody and got away with it. And she basically is who brought my mother up. And so there's a certain hystericalness that came from her that my mother got. And if I'm going to tell the truth, to some extent I have. You know, I have a monstrous temper and I have to watch it sometimes because I go off the deep end and it's terrible. It's just terrible. And I'm ashamed of it.
What do you do for yourself to try and check that?
Stop it, you know, because why put my wife up to that? You know, she doesn't have it coming. She's the greatest woman I ever met. I mean, to abuse her. But my historical rants, that's not a good thing. It's nothing to laugh at.
Yeah. So, what are some important things, like, because, like, we talk about your mom being a pinko in the 50s. I mean, that's within itself is kind of out there and wild. Is there any other things that stick out to you that would be like, here's something fascinating about my mother that, like, you don't know?
Well, I mean, yeah, they settled into being liberals, but there was a brief period when we were living in Detroit where they were, in fact, in the Communist Party. But it didn't last long. My mother said she learned a lot about bookkeeping while she was an actual communist. Just, I don't know, keeping the books for the commies, I guess. You know, by the time my father's living in communist Czechoslovakia, though, I don't think he was that communist. He was just more like a liberal fellow.
A liberal vagabond?
Yeah, well, you know, yeah, he did what he did, you know. I guess I did something similar to it myself when I had a kid, you know, I had to get out of it too. But, you know, everything we do is to be proud of. I'm not proud of a lot of the things I've done. Try to do better, try to move forward and be a better person. What else can you do?
Yeah. A lot of reflection today.
Well, trying to be honest.
Yeah, oh, I appreciate it. And I like how this goes into your work. And I feel like, so in Resurrection Stories, you have these great stories, these yarns about these characters. And then you kind of, at the end of the book, you actually go, here's who they really were. And that story about that. And I'm wondering about your own process of kind of when you find someone that you want to dive in further or share further, and the importance that those people have to you.
Well, I got all kinds of idols, you know. I'm full of hero worship all over the place. So
yeah,
like D.W. Griffith, fascinated by old movies. I made a study of his stuff, so that's where some of that came from, and why I keep dragging him back. Plus, I just read this great book called The 50-Year-Old Decline and Fall of Hollywood one time, and it starts with like this interview with D.W. Griffith when he's totally drunk, you know, about 6 months before he died in 1948. And it's just one of the greatest things I ever read. I mean, the whole book itself isn't super duper, but boy, the whole book is worth just that opening thing, this D.W. Griffith's last interview in 1948. Wild as could be. You know, of course, he came to a bad end, you know. I guess he always drank some, and by that time the booze had really caught up with him. Well, you got to stay away from that. I'm convinced. You know, I joined AA when I was in North Carolina working for some film guy, and that was the best decision I ever made, because I don't know where I'd be if I hadn't done that by now.
Well, you wouldn't be.
Maybe I'd still be alive, but I'd be just some decrepit, slow ass. I wouldn't be doing what I'm doing now, which is really
what you love.
Right in the thick of everything. And unbelievable to me that that is the case. And so I'm unbelievably grateful that it's worked out this way. And
I see it, like looking at you discussing old Hollywood stuff. And like old Western things in your work.
Westerns, yes.
Yeah. And then I think about like that, like linkages, like there's a photo of Buck Jones with Buffalo Bill, and thinking about.
Well, I know. I saw that. I flipped. Holy shit. Really connecting two different things together.
But also the another two things of you being an underground cartoonist, part of this like important creative generation, but also your connection to him, and then his, you know, like how that's a part of your story, or making it part of your story. I don't know if you actually met him or if it's a full on, you know, bait.
Who did I met? Oh, Jack Hoxie. Yeah. No, I never met him, but you know, I did meet when I was 7 years old. We went to the Thanksgiving Day parade. I met Hopalong Cassidy, shook his hand and everything. That's probably nice. The most greatest celebrity thing that ever happened to me. Poppy, you know, hey, you know, we got there early, you know, and we're standing around, and there's Hopalong Cassidy standing with his horse, and we're too young to realize the impropriety of it. We just, me and my brother Simon, just, hey, Hoppy, how are you doing? And it's great. He's, hi, kids, how are you? You know, he came over and shook hands with us and stuff. I couldn't believe it. You know, my parents were talking on the way home. Can you imagine that? What a nice guy he was about that. You know, So that was big.
Yeah. But I love this. Like,
couldn't believe it.
How we have, like, you know, I'm interested in the underground comic era as a historical era, and I get this chance to chat with you about it. But you're interested in this earlier era, and we all kind of have like this magic time that we dive into, right? And so, like, I find it neat with you that is that like old Hollywood, and it's like it's not a pretty picture, you know, it's the warts and all approach.
But you know, I'm interested in all that other stuff too. I mean, the underground and the development of that, I find it utterly fascinating.
Yeah.
And I'm so proud to be a part of it. I was so lucky that, you know, because, you know, you get to be about 18 years old and you're like, well, what am I going to do with my life? I don't like this art school thing so much. To sort of discover that, and it actually worked out, great. I keep saying that, I know.
But it's great. And part of the reason that I love it so much as a historian and a researcher is you guys were like, there was something really distinct with the stories you were doing that were your own stories, which was generationally different than the previous, where we're still seeing some amazing comics, you know, especially like the EC work and Craigstein and Kurtzman, but it's all predominantly work for someone else, work for hire, work for a system, where you guys are really that first big wave of people telling what they want.
We were out there. You know, the other big break for me was that, you know, getting Spain for a roommate, that was like a, you know, postgraduate course that money couldn't buy, you know. It was really tough on my lack of anatomical knowledge too. It did me a lot of good. He was a great guy.
And he was older too.
Yeah, he was born in 40. I was born in 44. So he was a great guy.
Yeah.
It wasn't like we were bosom buddies, but we got along great. And I miss him. Can't believe he's been like more than 10 years that he's gone.
It was
total integrity. There was a guy, a totally honest guy. Couldn't beat him.
Yeah. And I find it really interesting about how he got started in undergrounds as a much older, like he was older, but he also got started at an older age.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, he'd gone to some art school in the Buffalo area. But, you know, yeah, and he'd been around. So he'd been in that East Village scene, maybe about a year and a half. It's not that much. It seemed like a long time. He'd been there a whole year and a half before me. And I just got so lucky that he came over one day and my real roommate was off somewhere for weeks. He was a steward for some ship, a little neater than and cleaner than me on my merchant marine thing. But Spain just was looking around, goes, hey man, why don't you let me room with you? Sure. And that was really great. And that was tremendous. And that really opened the door at the East Village Other for me that much more. I'd been doing stuff there, but little by little, it sort of evolved into the day when suddenly we were making money there. I came in one day to pick up mail there, and Joel Fabricant, the guy who ran the place at that time, said, I want to talk to you. He brings me into this room. He says, you know, we're trying to improve the magazine. And wait a minute. Let me get Spain. Spain, get in here. Now, Spain, don't I pay you $40 a week? Said, yeah, man, you do. He says, that could be you too. And, you know, that was really when it really began. This guy who ran the place, Joel Fabricant, he was a Republican. He was no hippie, but he was really something else. You know, I loved that guy. I bless his memory. Sad to say he's no longer with us, but, you know, he's my true hero. If you really want to know who the real hero in the story that got me going, the man who really gave me my break, it was this guy, Joel Fabricant.
And while there, was that when you met a lot of your contemporaries? Like Crumb?
Some of them. Yeah, it was during that period when Spain and I were rooming together. One day, I'm sitting there working on a strip. Spain runs in and goes, "Hey, Kim, Bob Crumb's in town." And I said, "Really?" And then, you know, by the end of the day, Crumb's in our place. I didn't have to go to him. He came to us and even rooming with us for a while. And that was fascinating. You know, I saw those sketchbooks of his for the first time. It was intimidating, and also totally wonderful. And another priceless part of background that I was exposed to that time. I was just, it all worked out so amazing. I'm still scratching my head over it.
There's something about Crumb that, like, his creative spirit, his, you know, his work being so just out there and immediate and just
so amazing. Otherworld,
it's like the cartoonist that sailed, like, set 1,000 ships. Like, in terms of other folks, and I'm wondering, living with him and how that affected you firsthand in terms of, like, creatively drawing and producing and, like, your own work ethic being influenced by that.
He was so impressive to me that I've never really been able to be that comfortable around him. I'm just too in awe of him.
Yeah.
You know, I have a friendly, cordial relationship with him, but I've never been his buddy. I don't think it's possible for me to be his buddy, but I admire him as much as I admire anybody, especially in art. You know, and he's just the integrity of the man. He's one of the most amazing people I ever met.
I remember you said something to me about a drawing, like a drawing of a coffee cup by Crumb. Even that coffee cup has a soul. And I always think about that as, like, a great way to describe a Crumb drawing.
He's unbelievable. I mean, he's my personal favorite artist of all eras, of all ages, fine art, comic art, whatever.
Telling a good story, what do you look for as, like, this is what makes a good story? What are those key Kim Deitch ingredients?
Well, it's got to be interesting to me. I can't, you know, as long as I'm not boring myself, well, that's a good start, you know. And it's a good question, but I don't know. You know, it's, I like it to have a certain amount of heart, and sometimes it doesn't, sometimes it doesn't. It's a good question. I'd have to think about it more, which doesn't help you right now.
Because you talk about making stories and bouncing ideas off of Pam and how that process goes of, like, when you get that kind of germ, that ingredient that, like, lights you up to kind of want to dive in further, like, you know, you read about a person and you kind of want to really, like, explore their lives or tell a story that would embellish their life but still get to the core of who that person was.
You know, sometimes you want to do that, sometimes you're not that mindful of what the truth is. I'll tell you one thing about people who have influenced me. My brother Simon, he was really good because he'd tell me the truth, even was hard on me. Pam, it's a similar situation. She's not afraid of me. She's not afraid to tell me when she doesn't like something. That's very useful. It's always a good idea to have somebody like that around who's going to tell you the truth about stuff. And it's not so easy to find because a lot of people, you know, they're going to be polite and this and that. Find somebody, you know, and for a long time, it was my brother Simon, and he was even tougher on me because I think there was a jealousy factor going on. And that's definitely that person in my life right now is my wife, Pam.
She's able to push you in different directions.
Yeah, she'll, you know, count on her to get the truth. She doesn't bullshit me, you know?
Yeah.
So that's good. It's a good thing. You got to have somebody like that around. In my opinion, I think that's everybody should have somebody in this business should have somebody like that around them. It's part of the thing you need.
One thing you said in the book that really struck with me is this statement of proactive humility.
Yeah. I think that's a good statement. It just means like you want to be humble, but you don't want to be so damn humble that it puts you out of business. You know, so that's where the proactive part comes in. You know, you don't want to be all full of yourself, but you want to be able to keep it going.
Yeah.
So that's the proactive part. So it's, you know, you temper the humility with some energizing aspects of keeping things going. That's what it is. I'm proud of, I coined that phrase. I haven't coined very many phrases, but that's one I wouldn't mind seeing catch on.
In that book of quotes.
Yeah. That's the one I'd like to be remembered with.
I think about like when you say something about that and always this idea of always being open to learning and open to change. And
yeah, you got a learning thing going. Christ, you know, that's the trouble with a lot of people. They just get to a certain age and they stop learning anything new. And yeah. I guess that was pointed out to me as a human failing at some point. So I've always tried to watch my step about that.
How do you find that works into how you approach your comics and the way you tell characters?
I just try to keep learning stuff and not fall into lazy habits about it all. Keep myself on my toes as much as I can.
What do you mean by lazy habits? Is that just shorthand characters? Just like,
you know, just not learning new stuff, just sort of falling into, well, these are the things I like in life, and not pressing and trying to learn some new things, you know, like, yeah, you know, I love old movies and all that shit, but try to find other new things that I can have going on in my learning process. It keeps the learning process going. I think this is where so many people stop. You know, they get to be like 22, 27 years old, and they stop learning that much anymore. I'm trying not to have that happen to me.
Yeah, I appreciate that. And I think, you know, it's, I love, you know, it's talking with you today, it's like catching up with an old pal that you haven't talked to in a while and seeing how their approach has changed and seeing kind of how they look at comics differently. And I wonder about how you approach comics now versus, say, 15, 20 years ago.
Got better work habits. I'm more diligent. And
I feel like, because now you're talking about, you know, you got your 40-hour work week. I feel like you were doing more in the past where you were just like all the wake hours were drawing. It seemed like.
Well, you know, a lot of them are. I mean, I managed to get to that point where that's sort of how it is. I'm lucky enough to have a wife who doesn't come on with, and I've had this happen in other relationships, like, you know, Jesus Christ, Kim, all you ever do is draw this stuff. We don't ever do nothing. You know, I don't get that from her. She's a real heavy hitting, hardworking person too. So that's a great thing about our relationship.
Yeah. I mean, relationships are definitely all about kind of compromising for each other and understanding each other's complexities and lives.
Yeah.
Tell me about her cat addiction and how that's working into your or worked into your work, the cat toys. I
Oh,
follow
yeah. That's
or follow her
one
postings.
thing. You should see them. They're all over the place here, everywhere but where you're looking. And no, she's got a fabulous collection. I've learned a lot from watching her different collector crazes as well as my own. Well, I'm not that much crazed about collecting things anymore. I'm just, my hobby is see how high I can get the pile of on
Finish.
my of work. That's what I'm collecting. I'm collecting my own pages.
It's a lot of pages.
Yeah, I like, I hope it's going to be a lot more.
Now, we touched on this a little bit, but you talk about how I make comics and why you make comics, and I want to talk about how comics made you.
Well, I have. I mean, this career has been, it's been a certain making of me. And I managed to do it, clean up my act in the process over the years too. So I just hope I can keep it going for a while yet.
When you think of work that influences you, you mean you talk about always learning, do you still read other comics? I mean, you mentioned Dave Collier before we started, who's top tier storyteller.
I love Collier, and I also like the old, DC puts out a lot of these Golden Age reprint comics lately. I buy all of those, and what am I reading right now in comics? Somewhere I picked up a book of all the work of Joe Manili, who was a 1950s artist, and what else am I reading in comics? A second. I've got some other old comics books, and then I read real books too. I'm in the middle of a rereading of Time in the River by Thomas Wolfe. Was a great book. It's so good. I sort of keep suspending reading on it because I don't want to finish it too soon. I do that a lot when I really love something.
I remember when you were in Vancouver and we went book shopping, and one thing you were
Right,
really,
I remember that well.
yeah.
Those books. Yeah.
And the big thing you were looking for at that time was like 1950s children's cowboy books or earlier.
Yeah, well, I always had a soft spot for cowboy stuff and Western stories. One of my favorite writers is Max Brand, who was a failed poet, but a huge hit in pulps, writing rather superior Western stories for the pulps. I love those. I must have read 200 of his books. And of course, Zane Grey, too. I like him to a lesser extent. Max Brand's the man.
It's interesting at thinking back to that and then seeing how that kind of interest ended up in your comics, especially in the resurrection stories with the Western stories. And I'm wondering if that's kind of something that happens where you'll get like a particular obsession with something. And you really for a
Jesus
while.
will come upon me, And I like all the things I always like too.
Yeah.
I'd say the latest craze is I'm starting to like, we go to New Jersey every summer, and there's a really good comic book store there that I never went to, but then when my friend Bill Cartolopoulos was staying with us, he wanted to go in the comic book store, and all of a sudden I thought, shit, man, all this stuff. And I started collecting I got a whole pile of Wonder Woman books that I want to read through. There's something about the primitivity of that and just the whole story of Wonder Woman, the creators, same guy that created the lie detector. Pretty fascinating.
So and a polyamorous relationship.
Yeah. Yeah. So, you know, I'd like to learn more about him too, but I have got practically the complete Wonder Woman. I haven't read them all yet. Going from like 1942 to, I guess the books I have, they end around 1947. But actually that same guy, H.G. Peter, he drew it till 1958 with other writers.
Yeah.
So those
yeah, Bolt was the original writer, right?
The original writer was William Moulton Marston.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's pretty intriguing. I don't know everything about him yet. I'm still learning about him.
I think there's even a movie about him. And
I'd like to see that. I'd really like to see it. I have not seen the movie. I know what you're talking about. And I'm eager to see it, but I haven't seen it yet.
Did either. So the other night you did a comic reading.
Yeah, first one of those that I had to do. I gotta get out there and do that. I made a solemn promise to Gary Groth that he, you know, was gonna put out my next book and reprint another book, that I'd go to bat for him on all of this. So, you know, I'm not saying no to anybody, you know. Well, practically no one. And I mean, you know, it starts to eat into my work time too. I have to, but that's all right. For the moment, I'm not worrying so much about the 40-hour week because I've got to fulfill this promise to Gary Groth, get out there and really promote this thing.
I was telling someone I would love to see just like a thick book of your like 70s and 80s comics, of just like a big thick handful book, because there's just so many directions you go in and there's so much differentness, and it's like there's these out of print collections, but just to have something in depth like that.
It may happen, you never know. You know, I'm not too worried about it. I'm just worried about doing more stuff now. But, you know, I'll go along with any mad plans Gary Groth has, and hopefully I can make those plans happen better if I can promote good sales on the books that are out right now. So that's what I'm trying to do.
I appreciate it. I mean, it's comics are a lot of work, and I appreciate take the time. And I mean, you discuss a bit about your process, because it's not just doing the comic, it's the, you got to explore these stories before you dive in too deep in the process. But you're even your kind of, that first step is quite in depth. And when you like draw out some rough ideas to share.
Well, let's overlap to keep it going, which I'm afraid I'm not going to do this time, because I got to finish this. I finally figured out the story I'm working on now about how I got my start in comics. It's been bugging me over and over and over, right down to the last page. Over the weekend, I put about, well, I don't know, 2-3 hours working out the layout for that final page. So that was a big achievement. So now I've just got to go ahead and finish it, which will probably happen. I don't know if it's going to happen this week or early next week. It remains to be seen.
When do you plan on having this next book come out? Like a couple of years from now, or?
It's a good question. I don't know. You know, a lot of this work is going to come out sooner than that, because there's two different things are happening. There's a French publisher who's doing a whole thing about me as a series of books and stuff.
Oh, nice.
And then there's a guy in the States who's doing a similar thing. So I, not only am I working on stuff. I'm also preparing to have a lot of the stuff that will be my next book is probably going to hit print a lot sooner than when I have that book together. Yeah. In fact, you know, like my deadline for the French thing is September. I've got that pretty much together. And then John T. Kelly, I'm doing something for his magazine, Dummy. And yeah. So I'm doing those things as well right now. It's a big blitz, but yeah. I figured, you know, the opportunities are here, and this is how I'm going to fulfill my promise to Gary Groth and make some sales. Not only am I doing talks and stuff, but I'm going to have a couple of book things and print things that are going to be really interesting too by the end of the year. So
hopefully.
So that's, you've just forced out of me a little more of what's actually going on here.
A lot.
It's a lot. And I'm feeling it too. But, you know, that's okay. If not now, when?
Yeah. Well, I wonder, you know, not to sound too dark, but, you know, speaking in reality sense, I mean, we talk about eulogizing folks, you know, your friends and contemporaries, but also like doing a choice to do something really distinctly autobio. Is there a feeling of like there's parts of your own personal story you want to tell?
Sure, there are.
Back?
Absolutely. I'm interested in doing that, and I think I am doing it to some extent.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm not doing it to the extent that some people might be doing it. Like, I had lunch with Bill Griffith recently, and he's on the memoir thing, and he's got 400 pages now, and he's planning to have 400 more pages, to which I say, well, more power to him. And I believe he's in a good place with that, and I fully believe he's going to do something great.
Bill is so interesting. Someone said something to me where it's like, it's rare where you see someone who's on like a third or fourth phase of their art, and it's
wonderful,
and it's so good, it's so successful and so charming and lovely. Like,
I completely admire him, and
yeah.
You know, I've known him longer than any of the other people, because we got to know each other at Pratt when we same dormitory, so I've known Bill for 6 years.
And you probably live near each other in San Francisco, I'm presuming.
Yeah, for a while, yeah.
Yeah.
I've spent a lot of time with Bill.
Yeah. No, fantastic work.
He's a great guy, and he's doing amazing things right now.
Yeah. Well, Kim, I want to thank you for taking the time to chat with me this evening.
Sure. My pleasure. Enjoy talking to you, Robin.
Yeah.
Talk to you again after all these years.
Yeah, it's been a while. It's been a while.